Hello, friends and colleagues, and welcome to episode 100 of Dermasphere, the podcast by dermatologists, for dermatologists, and for the dermatologically curious. I am one of your hosts. My name is Luke Johnson. I'm a pediatric dermatologist and general dermatologist with the University of Utah. And sitting next to me is...
This is Michelle Tarvox. I'm an associate professor of dermatology at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in beautiful, sunny Lubbock, Texas.
Episode 100 is kind of a big deal. I remember back when we recorded episode 10, I was like, woo, double digits. Now we're in business. So now we got to look forward to quadruple digits. We happen to be physically together, which is unusual for us because we are here at the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar. Big shout out to those guys for letting us have a booth. If you happen to be watching a video of us for some reason, you'll see that there's pictures of our booth behind us. And we're recording this entire episode live from the exhibit hall at the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar. What we decided to do this time is something a little bit different. Instead of our usual thing where we talk about articles, we actually thought we would capture some of the faculty who are here at the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar, since they're such experts in their fields, and interview them, chat with them. So this is going to be a little bit disjointed in that we're going to grab somebody, and then for us it was like hours to days later, but for you guys it will be only seconds, and we suddenly talk to somebody else. But again, in this exhibit hall. So because there's few other people in the exhibit hall, I hope you'll forgive the background noise and the fact that we're doing something a little bit different, but we'll get it rolling here. I'm excited to try something a little bit different for episode 100. All right. We were lucky enough to ambush Peter Leo outside the exhibit hall.
Hey, everybody. It's great to be here. We're so excited to be together at this amazing conference in beautiful but currently kind of rainy Honolulu, Hawaii. Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
And because we just ambushed you, I know you've got like just 5 minutes to chat. So what do you wish every dermatologist should know about atopic dermatitis, for example, which I know is your expertise, but whatever you want to talk about.
Yes, I think that's my biggest thing that I'm interested in this conference in particular. Dr. Neil Bhatia and I are going to be talking about when to go up to appropriate systemic treatment. So don't be afraid to jump to a biologic when it's appropriate. Don't be afraid to use a JAK inhibitor. Don't even be afraid in the appropriate cases to use phototherapy or our conventional immunosuppressants. I think, you know, we're trying always to minimize the amount of treatments. We're always trying to stay with our good topicals. We're trying to be as safe as we can and cost effective. But for those patients who need more, I want every dermatologist to feel empowered to do it, because honest to goodness, we're the people to do it. This is really our bailiwick. This is our wheelhouse, if you will. And I talk to clinicians all the time who say, gosh, you know, I'm a little nervous. I don't really use them that much in my practice. So I think we're trying to empower everybody that for the appropriate patient, go for it. I think the tremendous quality of life impact really can change everything for these patients.
Some of them are really miraculous for patients. I think we've probably all seen that in practice, and we've discussed a lot of the articles on this podcast about, hopefully, things that should make you feel comfortable using them. Peter, we're asking a bunch of the faculty here, what has changed in dermatology since you graduated residency or were a medical student, both for good and potentially bad in the field?
For good, I would say there is a renewed understanding of some of the mechanisms of disease that has led to this, what I like to call the virtuous cycle of therapeutics. We got better and more targeted treatments that are making a bigger difference than ever before. So that's been amazing. The biologic revolution, I got to watch that happen. I remember one of my favorite teachers in residency was a little bit nervous about using biologics when they first came out. And now they're, you know, something we use all the time. For the negative side, I think we have had to get our hands dirty in a way with billing and reimbursement and cost in a way that is probably not all for bad, but has really stretched a lot of us. And I think the burden on us, this kind of moral, you feel this moral injury, this burnout, I think this is tangible and this is going to affect medicine going forward.
Yeah, I think sometimes the good medicines that really can help the patient are the hardest ones to get. And often you have to swim through a river full of crocodiles and climb over a piece of land that's on fire for some reason to get the patient the medicine they need.
Well, they're very expensive. So even though they're good, and they really are good, they're safe and effective. This is what I tell my patients. We should start dupilumab. It's safe and effective. I wish all medicines were as safe and effective as dupilumab. The main downside is that it's super expensive and it's delivered by a shot, and a lot of kids hate shots. So we do have to be appropriate stewards of healthcare dollars as well, but you mentioned that. We want to treat things with a consciousness about the cost, but there are certainly patients where you've tried topicals for long enough, and if they need clobetasol every day, then that's not feasible. Peter, what advice do you have for current dermatology residents or medical students, besides to come to the wonderful Hawaii Dermatology Seminar and listen to your official presentation, of course?
Yes, definitely come here and listen. I think that maybe the best advice I can give is to try to find ways to continue to diversify your learning. For me, part of my interest in integrative approaches has been something that's revitalized my excitement for medicine and health and disease. And I honestly believe, maybe, you know, I guess history will be the judge, but I believe it makes me a better doctor. I'm thinking outside of the box all the time so that even when I'm using conventional treatments, my patients know that I'm thinking about it a little bit from a larger perspective. So don't be afraid to challenge your ideas. Don't be afraid to learn from different places. I always think about Paracelsus, who was an iconoclastic doctor. He was often called the father of toxicology, but also was the father of balneology. He used to say he would go to these places, talk to the midwives, talk to the people doing folk medicine, because he said, listen, these people are doing stuff from experience. You don't have to turn your nose up and say this is baloney because it's not coming from the establishment.
Okay, tell me, what is the most common non-traditional Western medicine thing you do for your patients?
I do a lot of different stuff. Probably the most common thing I do is probably topical vitamin B12, which we call pink magic. So there's actually some pretty interesting evidence on topical vitamin B12 cobalamin, and it comes as a powder. We have it made for our patients, so it comes in as a pink cream. Basically, it's a white base, and it looks pink. It's beautiful. One of my patients early on called it pink magic, so that name stuck. But it really does have a measurable anti-inflammatory effect in atopic dermatitis. It's steroid-free. It's relatively cheap. We even have a recipe that can make it at home. I mean, total cost is like $20 for a several-month supply. So that's one of the most common things I use. It's not going to replace clobetasol. That I can promise you. But it certainly can be an adjunct, particularly for babies, where we don't want to use very harsh treatments.
Amazing. We'll have to have you back to discuss some of those studies. All right, Peter, I know we've already taken up some time and you're a busy man. So thanks so much for being here. It's awesome to be here in Hawaii with you.
Thank you so much, you guys. I'll see you in a little bit.
You're going to rock your talk.
All right. We are fortunate enough to have with us next Linda Steingold, one of the key faculty here at the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar. Dr. Steingold, thanks so much for coming on the show with us.
Thanks for having me.
Do you want to start just by introducing yourself?
Well, hello, everybody. My name is Linda Steingold. I am a medical dermatologist. I run the clinical trials at Henry Ford Dermatology, and I attend and run some of these meetings.
And earlier in the conference, you were discussing a lot of your research into acne treatments, and you've been involved in a lot of some of the more recent acne treatments that have come around. Cool
yeah.
to see that.
Yeah, that is, it's a lot of fun. I do all of kind of general dermatology, including acne and rosacea, but also psoriasis and atopic dermatitis. And fortunately, recently we've had a lot of really great new developments, so it's exciting.
It is an exciting time to be a dermatologist. Speaking of...
We thought it was really exciting how some of the new medications are utilizing not just new drug combinations, but also new formulations to help improve efficacy and tolerability. And you did a fabulous presentation over those. Is there anything you'd really like our listeners to know about?
Well, I would say learn about the new drugs, because it's very easy just to pick up and use traditional generics. But there are a lot of advantages to some of the new formulations and some of the new molecules. You know, it's really important that our acne patients be able to tolerate their treatments, and they want to see good efficacy. So, you know, the most expensive drug is the one that's never used. So, you know, really learn about what's new, and because we have some really wonderful options.
That's so wonderful. We like to ask if anybody has a favorite practice pearl they'd like to share with the listeners. We'd love to hear those.
You know, one of the things that I've started doing recently is taking more pictures. And because, and I know people do this in practice, but it had been something that I was doing because it takes a little bit of time. But I do like to take a picture, whether it's acne or psoriasis, especially if I'm starting a new medication, and put it in the chart. And sometimes I'll tell a patient, again, with a newer medication especially, go ahead and send me an update picture. And, you know, it's week one or month one. And I think it really makes the patient feel that I'm much more engaged with them and much more invested in their treatment plan. But it also helps me to understand how these newer medications are working in real life.
That's wonderful. And that's also a touch point that helps with compliance, because they know that you're seeing if they're using the medicine.
That is true, because again, compliance is tough. So patients want to have an idea of when they'll start to see an effect. So I'll usually say, you know, don't send me in a day or two, but maybe in a few weeks or so, send me a picture. And also when the patient comes back and tells me they're no better, I pull out their pictures. I say, no, I think you're actually a little better. Mm-hmm. So it's helpful.
I do that routinely with vitiligo because I think sometimes it's really hard for families to see a difference there, but maybe I should be doing it with some of these other conditions too. We've been asking a lot of the folks here what's changed the most since you were in residency, and it sounds like this is a couple of them. A lot of new cool treatments that are coming out, especially topical acne stuff. Also the photograph thing, I'm assuming, is new. It's new for me. Anything else that you've noticed that's been a big change in dermatology?
Well, I think we have good and we have some bad things. And, you know, when I first started to practice, if we prescribed a medication, our patients got that medication, whether it was branded or generic, it really didn't matter that much. And our lives have changed so dramatically that if we do choose to prescribe a branded medication, it takes a lot more effort. So that's a not so great thing. And there are times when I think we really do need to pick a branded medication because they offer options. And I usually take the time to explain to a patient why I'm choosing one option versus another. And I do believe in some joint decision-making to make sure we're both on board. But on the good side, what I think has changed is that we understand the pathophysiology of disease so much better. We understand psoriasis. We are targeting our treatments. We understand the pathogenesis of atopic dermatitis. I've had to learn all kinds of new things. I didn't know what a Th17 cell was. I didn't know about IL-4 and IL-13. So, you know, we're having to continue to learn, but I think that's exciting.
I agree with what you said about trying to get medications covered. Sometimes I feel like the insurance companies get to decide what our patients get treated with instead of doctors, which doesn't seem right. Since you've been dealing with this stuff, do you have any tips on how to get stuff approved?
It can be a challenge, but a lot of times companies have put in place mechanisms that makes our job a lot easier. So to try to figure out, first of all, what do they have in place? Do they have our particular form that we need to fill out where they will potentially help us to get the drug? Is there a particular pharmacy that works better than others? Which companies have their drug on formulary and which don't? So I do try to kind of keep up on what's the path of least resistance.
Yes, I remember I kept trying to prescribe Hemangiol and it could never go through until I realized I had to send it to this particular pharmacy. It's kind of discouraging that part of being a doctor in the United States is having to know some of these tricks, but we do what we have to for our patients.
Now, what advice would you give to current dermatology residents?
The advice that I would give is basically to figure out if there's some area in particular that you're passionate about. And, you know, try to learn as much as you can. Continue to read. Continue to stay up. Just because you finish your residency doesn't mean that you stop learning. So really stay engaged. Try to find a mentor, somebody who's doing exactly what you want to do. Because you finish your residency, that's the very beginning of your journey. So, you know, you can do whatever you want to do. If you want to stay in private practice and see patients, that's great. If you want to go into academics, that's great. If you want to do clinical trials, you know, just try to figure out which path you're going to be the happiest in.
I love that advice. And you actually read my mind because my next question for you is going to be, what are you passionate about?
What am I passionate about? you know, I really enjoy the clinical trials. That has been fun. And I get to see dermatologic diseases from so many different avenues. You know, I get to see them because I'm a medical dermatologist, so I see patients. I get to see the diseases and the new treatments because I do the clinical trials. And you get an insight into the drugs and everything that goes behind getting a drug before the FDA. And so I certainly appreciate the clinical trial aspect. I certainly appreciate how much effort and money goes into getting a drug approved. But it's fun. And I actually love the fact that in a clinical trial setting, it's not like real life. Mm-hmm. You know, in real life, you see a patient, you say, all right, I'll see you back in a month. And then they say, you don't have an appointment in a month. It's going to be 3 months. And you're like, well, you know, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. In clinical trials, you know, I might see you at 1 week, at 2 weeks, at 4 weeks, at 8 weeks. It's not real, mm-hmm. but that's how we do it. You really get to see how those drugs work. And, you know, if a patient doesn't come back to you, if you prescribe something, did they not come back because they never got the medication? Did they not come back because they got it and it was terrible and they hate you and they went on to somebody else? Or did they not come back because it was so great they're now cured?
I always hope it's the last one.
Yeah, we all do. But you know what? Sometimes it's not. So in the trial setting, we actually get to see what happens. So that I think that's fun.
It kind of reminds me of our isotretinoin patients. As much as we sometimes rail against iPledge, it's actually kind of cool to see people every month and check in and see how they're doing.
I agree. I think that's just so life-altering. And the best part is just watching, you know, that face and that smile. I take pictures of my isotretinoin patients now, too, because it's so fulfilling when they come back at the end of treatment and you pull up that initial treatment. It's really great.
I love that idea. I remember when I was like an adolescent and in braces, when we walked into the orthodontist, there were a bunch of like before and after pictures of patients on the wall. We could certainly do the same thing with some of our patients.
Yeah, definitely some of the most satisfied patients.
One of my favorite gifts I ever got from a patient was this sweet teenager that was a little gothy. She was a little bit like Wednesday from the hit TV show, but she had really bad acne. And when she finished her course of Accutane, well, she knew it was going to be her last visit. She gave me this beautiful little picture frame she'd painted by hand. And she had on one hand had her like pre-treatment pictures. And she had decorated that with all of these like toxic looking things. Mm-hmm. And then on the other picture slide, she had like her post-treatment photograph and she'd put all these like things that made her happy, which were bats and Jack Skellington and things like that. But she was very pleased about it.
That's actually lovely. It really is. It's nice.
Well, speaking of young people, you mentioned advice for residents. Any advice for the medical students who are listening to this?
Yeah, let me just tell you, my two sons went to medical school. And so, you know, I've lived through this journey myself and I've lived through it as a parent. And I think it's more stressful as a parent. But I would say if you can figure out what area you're most passionate about early, that's such a wonderful gift. If you are interested in dermatology, it's a tough field, but there are certain tricks of the trade. And that means trying to find a mentor, you know, be willing to go and do some research that might not be the most fun, but some way that you can actually help somebody that's doing what you want to do. Be enthusiastic, always be polite. And what I tell my kids is, you know, say hello, say thank you, go up to people. Don't be afraid to just make that initial, you know, don't be a pest, but don't be afraid to go say hello and meet people. And don't be afraid to reach out because people, you know, a lot of us are really busy, but, you know, we don't mind sitting down for a few minutes and you know, figure out how somebody is who's doing exactly what you want to do. What was their journey like and what did they do? And if you can manage to do some research, especially if you want to go into dermatology or spend some time in a dermatology clinic, even just volunteering, you'll be much more educated. And I think you'll put yourself in a better position to actually get a residency spot.
I also want to give some advice to medical students. Come to clinic on time. Early is even better. Dress nicely. Men, start by wearing a tie. If no one else is wearing one, maybe you can ditch it on day two or three. And when you go into an exam room with your attending, put on gloves and be ready to help them do whatever they're going to do. Some practical things that I often notice.
I want to tell you something. That is exactly what I tell my kids and other students is show up early, leave late. If you're giving a presentation, I always tell them bring some food, you know. But that's it. Always look the part. You know, little things like that make such a difference.
I agree. Well, we really appreciate your time today, Dr. Steingold. Any final thoughts you want to leave our listeners with?
This is such an exciting time in medicine, and especially in dermatology. We can do really great things. And I would say we have so many new treatment options. Take the time to learn them, because the only way you can be the best advocate for your patients is really understanding the treatment options, the good, the side effects, which treatment for which patient. And I think we can make a major difference.
Hello, welcome back to the podcast. So we are today with Dr. Mashin Kluska, dermatologist and researcher and presenter extraordinaire, also personal friend for many, many years as we both were at the Cleveland Clinic together.
Hi, Michelle. How
Hello,
are you?
Natasha.
Hi.
Hi, Natasha. Thanks for being on the podcast. You're also faculty here at Hawaii Dermatology.
For sure. I'm faculty at pretty much 80% of the meetings nowadays.
What are you going to be talking about?
Actually, this is funny. People are like, what did you start doing? Cosmetics all of a sudden? Don't you do like hair and inflammatory stuff? The thing is, you live in Southern California, Orange mm-hmm. County, you know, like housewives of Orange County. I'm a vice chair for clinical research, so we run a lot of clinical trials. And some of those trials are devices and beautification stuff. So I am here, part of the aesthetic faculty. Thank you very much. And we are going to be discussing non-invasive tightening of skin for face and collagen supplements, niacinamide supplements, what's doing, what's not doing, kind of the aging paradigm.
Very cool.
Different, right?
I like this. Well, this is a question that I think both of us will have similar answers to, but what has changed the most about our field since you graduated dermatology residency?
I mean, what did we have when we were graduating? So coming out on almost 8 years, mm-hmm. nine, we didn't have treatment for many of the things that have mm-hmm. been personal passion, right? For like the last 8 years, part of being the chief medical officer for National Alopecia Areata was to get a medicine on the market. Mm-hmm. And it happened. Yay! So
yeah, baricitinib, for those keeping track at home, we discussed the clinical trials that got it approved a few episodes ago.
So I was kind of lucky in that sense that during residency, I hooked up with Wilma Burgfeld and I got a grant to help out National Alopecia Areata. So when I was moving to the West Coast, I got a job with them, which is nothing that you learn in med school, right? Mm-hmm. And I was well underpaid, but it was such a passion to like knock on all these big companies without naming pharma names doors and be like, hey guys, I know you have the meds. Can you give it to us? They're like, what is this disease? What is it? So really first half of that quote unquote career was to help the community kind of learn what's alopecia, get the statistics, get the stuff, help the scientists get the things on the door and they get pharma interested. So a lot of things that I never thought I would do personally, because I think I'm kind of introvert, but I had to turn into an extrovert.
Well, you do a fabulous job of it.
Yeah, thanks. You wear a good disguise as an extrovert. I've been watching you and Michelle here for the past couple days.
It's like, dear God, there's two of them.
You know, I can't fight it for myself, but for my patients, I'll fight.
That's fair. I like it. Tooth and nail. I had a co-resident who once said, I will fill out 100 million forms, but you've got to do something too.
I don't know. Like, I cannot return a pair of shoes that don't fit me, but I will sure have 5-hour conversations why medication has to be approved.
So myself, and I think our listeners, always like real practical tips that you've picked up during your time in practice. Pearls or other tips and techniques that you have found to be helpful.
Okay, so because I guess most of my stuff is hair loss, although this meeting is what it is. I always say, get off the chair, go examine the patient. Don't rely on labs. Labs really don't tell you much. I know we're all like still checking people for deficiencies, et cetera. Get off the chair.
I've never found thyroid disease. I look for it all the time.
I've found paraffinically low iron stores, but I've not found a lot of the thyroid.
Right, but even like a lot of times, even if you fix it or address it, it does not really fix the problem. You know what you'll see in a lot of the people that have hair loss? You'll see a lot of scale guys. Mm-hmm. So much severe seb derm, sebo psoriasis, AKA psoriasis. Like I actually have come up to some of our big psoriasis people in meetings, not to be too big of a pest. I'm like, hey, can you tell me what's the difference for like really severe sebo psoriasis and what do you call like scalp psoriasis? And people don't really have an answer. Bottom line is, I think when you examine the scalp and you see some of this inflammation, psoriasis can go hand in hand with alopecia areata. You can see white patches, vitiligo goes hand in hand with alopecia areata. If nothing else, just that little inflammation. And I would tell you, Taclinix has done so much more for me than any of those labs. So sorry for dropping names, but like vitamin D and topical steroids. So bottom line is fix. Yeah, that's what I would say. Practical pearls. Don't rely on your labs. Look in there. Is that good enough for you? Good enough.
That's great. So Taclinex specifically is calcipotriene/betamethasone combination product.
But you can totally erase that from.
We don't erase it. We're not sponsored by anybody. We can say whatever we want.
We use whatever name helps people find the product that will help their patients.
By the way, I've also had similar products compounded for patients who can't, whose insurance won't cover the branded Taclinex stuff. You can probably get it compounded by a local pharmacy for something like $50 to $60.
And sometimes on their site, the suspension, which is more like gooey kind of jelly-like stuff, gets the card that gets them like very, very low.
What's the formulation that you think works the best?
Whatever gets covered.
Yeah.
I mean, people with curly hair, whoever has curly hair, they can tolerate oil. salves and maybe ointments. And if they have dry scalps, like curly hair, they can take it more oily, but everybody else probably suspension or solutions unless alcohol burns them.
We think of, we've touched on this a little bit, but what are you passionate about? So I know like hair is something you're passionate about.
I don't know. I'm passionate. I am very passionate about hair. I'm passionate just about, like I get very excited about kind of busting myths. I don't know if that makes sense.
I like that.
Like, you know, like a lot of time people are like, why are you writing these review articles on like collagen and on like the coconut oil and the argan oil or like just like random things, but they're not random to me. These are questions that people are using or people have, but we don't really have answers in our textbooks. Mm-hmm. So one thing I know how to do and the trainees that we have is to do these meta-analysis, to do these systematic reviews and try to dig out what's out there. We reach out to pharmacists, but I like kind of solving real life puzzles, like all of us. I think that's why you're going to, that's my passion is just kind of figuring out stuff that's still
hasn't been figured out. Ooh, tell me some of the myths you've busted.
Oh, come on. I didn't say I busted. I said I tried to bust.
Tell me about coconut oil and argan oil.
Well, so when you look at all the oils, for example, like argan oil, very expensive, goes really bad really fast. It needs to be kind of stored in dark places. So a lot of things that claim to actually have argan oil, they may have a drop or two, but not the real thing. So that's some of the things. If you buy a bottle, which we do to test and see, it goes rancid pretty quick if you don't take care of it well. Coconut oil actually is one of the oils that's shown to moisturize the fiber. So there is legitimacy to it. The problem is how do we educate providers? Is it good for every hair type? It was only tested in one thing, but there is something to it when it comes to moisturizing the fiber.
As long as we're on the subject of oils, my memory of what I learned about oils is sunflower oil, safflower oil, and coconut oil have medical data to support that they're especially good for the skin. And olive oil can disrupt your natural oils. So this is what I usually tell patients if they want to do something with oil just as a moisturizer or to moisturize their scalp.
I think the whole JLo line is about to call you right now and be like, we're based on olive oil, what are you doing?
I'm not familiar with that line.
You don't know JLo's line? It's all no, olive.
Somehow I don't.
No, the only concern I have with olive oil, so olive oil has been part of practices of the Mediterranean area forever, right? When it comes to skin. For hair, I don't know. When it comes to skin. The one thing is, what do we do when we want to grow Malassezia in the lab?
Yep.
Put an olive oil overlay. So that's why I'm not necessarily a fan of olive oil for the scalp, just because it can make that yeasty just be a little bit more yeasty, at least in my mind.
Yes.
I think you're probably right about that.
Now, do you have any advice that you give to residents that rotate with you or any advice you'd like to share with residents currently in training?
I think I'm probably like one of those annoying attendees that still is like, here's this. And read tonight. I make everybody read or like.
And I applaud that you take the time to do that. I'm usually so tired by the end. I feel like such a bad preceptor sometimes.
Well, listen, everybody that goes into Dharma residence, they're so smart, right? Like they're so smart. They know a lot. So it's challenging to teach smart people, but I feel like they keep me on my toes. So when there's this one thing where I feel like they're not 100% and God knows I'm like, definitely not 100%. I'm like, why don't you like read on that and teach all of us? Or like email me by tonight and they will do it.
Kudos to you for prompting them. I kind of wanted them to do it without prompting. So residents and medical students out there, something that really impresses me is when you guys can teach me something, especially if it has something to do with a patient that we've seen. Like, Dr. Johnson, did you know that phototherapy has been shown to help this condition or whatever? That's pretty cool.
See, I don't like being disappointed or stood up. So if I wait for people to come up with something, I'd rather leave interaction. It's probably so annoying to them. It really probably is. For the med student, I'm always like gloves on because I swear the one thing we're going to need a med student's help is when something's bleeding, they're not going to have their gloves. I'm like, at least put them in your pocket. But that's my one thing. You just have gloves and be ready and anticipate. It's never the smartest med student. It's the one that anticipates the best.
Absolutely. I think that you can't underestimate the power of somebody who pays attention and is willing to be helpful.
But what is the cost of all of these gloves that people are throwing in the trash if we never actually do a biopsy on that patient?
Well, I think if you're doing a procedure, they should put the gloves on.
No, I think they should put them on either way. Yeah. There's a lot more waste in medicine. We don't have to worry about this one. Well, Natasha, thanks a lot for joining us, taking time out of your day here in Hawaii. Any final thoughts you want to leave for our listeners?
I just have to tell you guys how good of a job you're doing and how excited I am for everything. Like, this is something that's needed so much. And my residents love you. The med students love you. So thank you for doing all the good stuff and keep doing it. 200 more.
Our next guest is Dr. Alok Patel. Dr. Patel, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Can I tell you guys that you have the coolest banner in this exhibit hall? I'm honored to be here.
It is pretty sweet, and it's right behind you.
I know. I kind of want to be one of these superheroes. I know that the listeners can't see it, but just think about like Marvel meets dermatology. That's where we're at.
I've finally reached my lifelong dream, superhero plus dermatology plus video game, plus now Dr. Patel, who I think I can refer to as the MC of the Hawaii Dermatology Seminar.
So you can, and what's funny is most people don't realize that medical conferences have or should have an MC, but it's both been really fun. And I also think, and you two can correct me right if I'm wrong, I think the attendees actually like having someone who practices healthcare and also kinds of wants to talk and like share tidbits.
And you are also a media expert.
I don't know if I could say that I'm an expert per se, but I do work in journalism. I work in broadcast. I work as a correspondent for ABC News and do some freelance work and with Medscape. Now, expert versus I just love running my mouth in the name of science and health. That's what I'll say. I also still work as a pediatric hospitalist. Yes, I'm one of those TB doctors who still love seeing patients.
That's wonderful.
Hey, I like running my mouth too, but I'm bad with social media. I'm assuming you're very good at it and you've seen some ways in which it's kind of impacted healthcare, patients, and also provided information to other providers, both good and bad. You want to speak to that a little bit?
Absolutely. And, you know, it actually falls in line a lot with what you all are talking about at this conference, especially because as a pediatric hospitalist, I see a lot of teens. I see a lot of patients who have systemic diseases that sometimes manifests with cutaneous findings. And I immediately am consulting dermatology. I also hear from patients and from people a lot about things that they see on social media, on mainstream media. And they're like, oh my gosh, does this mask work? Does this pill work? Well, if I stop eating this food, will it cure my eczema? You really see the concrete effects of a floodgate of information and how it affects what people are doing when it comes to their skin health.
Well, I think that you did a perfect job of starting this meeting off with high energy and positivity. I loved your lead into the very first session. It got me hyped. It got me excited to learn. What is your secret for staying so engaged with medicine?
Whoa, that's a loaded question. But I think that everything that we do when it comes to communication, whether it is grand rounds, whether it is a noon conference or a large keynote speech, has to come from a performative place. We are performing first. We're getting our audience engaged, excited, scared, anxious, whatever it is, some emotion, and then we're delivering the content. So it's like sugar-coated medicine. You know what I mean?
Well, and there's good data that tells us when you engage people's emotions, they retain things better. So it's actually very intelligent to bring that limbic system online when you're trying to teach people something important.
You said it in a more eloquent way than I do, but I will say that both of you and all your colleagues at this conference have definitely done that. I'm looking at one of the coveted programs right now. And, you know, there's things like the injectable skills workshop and, you know, addressing hair concerns. It's not just a rash, the medical dermatology medley. Like the presenters are coming from a place of wanting to engage and enlighten. And it's really cool to watch. And it's actually cool to hear from everyone I've interviewed about how much they're retaining and how they're going to change their practices when they go back, like, which is rad.
Absolutely. Every session has had actionable content that I feel like I can take home and practice better medicine with. And I'm so grateful for the organization, structure, and presentations that they've presented here.
Yeah, I'm not a dermatologist, but I'm also grateful for the fact that I'm asking all of you about skincare tips. And I'm like, oh, mineral-based sunscreen, vitamin C, all that jazz. I'm here for it. I need to get my glow to be at the level of all of you.
You are, in fact, a pediatrician, I understand. So we'd like to have you on maybe a little bit later in this episode to talk a little bit more about that aspect.
Oh, I will be there. And I have stories about the many times I've called dermatology at like 2 a.m. Just you wait.
All right. We'll let you go for now, but we'll see you soon. Next up, we have cosmetic dermatologist extraordinaire, Dr. Michael Kaminer. Dr. Kaminer, really appreciate you taking time out of your day to be here with us.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Do you want to start just by introducing yourself?
I think you just...
Cosmetic dermatologist extraordinaire. You practice in Boston, I understand.
Yeah, I do. I'm one of the founders of a practice called Skincare Physicians. We have about 100 employees, 15 dermatologists. We do everything in derm. PD derm, Mohs, skin cancer surgery, women's derm, general derm, cosmetic derm, lasers. We we cover everything. It's a very academic place. We publish dozens of papers a year. We have a whole research facility. We do a lot of research. And I'm also on the faculty at Yale and teach in the dermatology department there.
Sounds like you don't really have a lot of time for anything else.
Except for you guys.
We had one of our colleagues request to ask you, with such a successful practice, for people who are sort of just starting out, do you have any tips or tricks for how to build a successful practice, and also how to maintain one and how to attract talent?
Well, it's a hot topic now because, to be quite direct, just because of social media. And that's different than information and podcasts and things that we're doing here. I'm just talking social media. And we're seeing a lot of people who are just getting started who are seeing that lure of what social media can do. And they're using that as their vehicle to become busy and well-known. And personally, I think that is a bit of a strategic error. And primarily because good work always triumphs, not evil, but you know what I'm trying to get at. Good work always triumphs in the end. Mm-hmm. And I think if you're so focused on social media, not that you can't be focused on social media and good work, but social media without being truly sort of a skilled practitioner who devotes time to your practice, devotes time to your patients, importantly devotes time to your community, because those are the things that really help, then you're just going to be sort of like an intermittent flash in the pan, depending on what your most recent post was. And if you want an enduring, which is part of, I think, your question, like how do you create a reputation and then maintain it? I think it's less about your social media presence, and we could debate how much social media is a good thing. But I think ultimately getting back to what our core is, which is focus on the patients, focus on your skill set, do everything right, let your patients build your business for you. That to me, I think, is a winning formula.
Well, you had some wonderful sessions earlier today and made some fantastic points about the fact that sometimes what looks good and attracts attention in a social media post doesn't look good in real life. And most of what defines well-done aesthetic work is subtlety, which doesn't always sell in social media.
Well, I think it's also tricky because you and I might completely agree that what defines well-done aesthetic work is subtlety, but other people might say, no, that's not it at all. Like, I need something to jump off the page, screen, whatever it is. And the best example I can have is, people talk about the lip flip, which is done with one of the neurotoxins. Well, lip flips can work beautifully in a static social media post. But then when that same person then goes to try and have a bite of food after they're done taking their photo, they can't eat or they're drooling. And it doesn't happen all the time. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to overstate it, but there is a difference between what looks good on a static social media post and what looks good when you're out with your family or friends or other people. So, I think being cognizant of that is really important for not becoming a flash in the pan, for being somebody who's known as doing quality work.
Well, and I loved in the sessions today, you kept going back to the anatomy and then proportion. And I think those are such important tenets of well-done aesthetic work. What points would you give to residents that are learning aesthetic techniques, to people who are trying to build their skill set?
Yeah, and it was interesting. Dr. Bertucci made the point today, which I thought was one of the smartest things I heard all day, which is, many people can learn how to inject something, but the hard part is knowing where to inject it. And assessing the face is not only a skill set, it becomes a bit of an art form. And I really think that focusing mostly on how do I do this? How do I build a lip? Whatever it is, that's probably less important in the long run than how do I assess what somebody needs and then do that part. And I think that's, I think, an under-recognized component of training and something I think people could actually start to focus more on.
As long as we're talking about injections, we had an article that we discussed on the podcast, episode 48, where there was controversy about whether or not to aspirate before injecting filler. Where do you land on that?
So that came up a lot in today's session as well. Personally, I'm not an aspirator because I just find that it's unreliable enough that I don't want to give it a false sense of security. But I am an anatomist. And I think in order to be a great cosmetic surgeon, you have to be an even better anatomist. You have to really understand what the anatomy is telling you. You have to know where your trouble is. So if I'm somewhere where there's a vascular component that might get me in trouble, I'm going to use a cannula. Then I don't have to worry about aspirating as much. But if I'm in places where that doesn't happen, then I might use a needle, but I don't aspirate because I know I'm not someplace that's going to get me in trouble. Other people disagree. They say that you should always aspirate. The problem is sometimes when you aspirate, you get false negatives. And that's that false sense of security and then getting a false negative. That starts to worry me a little bit. So that's why I don't do it. But a lot of people do, and it could be a very open debate about that.
We've been asking a lot of our guests to tell us what has changed a lot about the field of dermatology since you finished residency.
Boy, it's been a lot has changed. I think one thing that has remained the same is most of the people who go into derm, I'd like to think it's all of them or all of us, still care about the skin. Like, that's why we do it. And we find lesions and pigmented lesions and rashes and dermatoses. We all find that stuff sort of in a nerdy way kind of cool. Like, that's sort of our foundation. So I'd like to hope that that's the same. But then there's so much more you can do now, right? All the fields have exploded. PD derm, derm path, cosmetic derm, skin cancer surgery. There's so many different ways that you can go. And when I first started, there were fewer ways that you can go. Now that there's more ways that you can go, one of my hopes is that the general derm component doesn't get lost in the shuffle because you've moved away from it. I think, a big risk.
Kind of going the way of general medicine. Everything is so subspecialized now.
Yeah.
How fragmented can it be?
What are you most passionate about? Like, what gets you excited to come to work in the morning?
Well, after what I just said, I primarily do cosmetic stuff. But in our practice, we sort of cover the whole playing field, including general derm. But, you know, I think the thing that I personally like to do is sculpt faces and sculpt bodies, like things that involve sort of a medical and artistic component to it. So I tend to be an injector. I do a lot of injections. There are parts of me that are a little bit of a body sculptor, and I do a lot of work with cellulite. And so I think things that are sort of creative, and then the innovative part. So doing the research that says, okay, what's our next filler going to look like? What's our next cellulite treatment going to look like? What's our next body sculpting treatment going to look like? What new skin tightening device do we have? And doing the research to help to further that. Those are things that I think make going to work every day exciting.
I think the variety too, it's so good for our brains to be able to go from one space to another space, and so you don't get totally saturated in one area.
I couldn't agree with you more. And it's funny, I've talked to a lot of colleagues over the past few years with the pandemic and how people have sort of evolved their careers. And I think that's been an important part of it, that people say, look, like, I don't want to only do one thing, but I want to right size my life for me. Mm-hmm. And then picking a couple things that I like to do and either including them in each week or in my month. I agree. I think that that's an important part of it.
What practice pearls or practical tips would you like to share? Our listeners and me are always interested in things I can just go and use in the clinic tomorrow, if I was going to work tomorrow, but I'm in Hawaii.
That's the first practice pearl. Take vacation, treat yourself well, make sure you do things. I think for me, the things that I do primarily involve cosmetic treatments. The first practice pearl, probably my most important one, if I'm just sort of like thinking, thanks for catching me off guard, is don't get lulled into thinking that everything that sort of pops up in front of you, that maybe it's a new treatment or a new technique, don't get lulled into thinking because it's new, it's better. And I'm seeing so much of this now where these new devices are coming out and they're no better than what else is out there, but they're either more expensive or better bells and whistles, where somebody will describe a new technique to do something that you're already able to do. And you think, well, because they described it, I should probably shift to do it that way, only to find out 6 months, a year later, that maybe has more complications. So that's probably my number one pearl, is like, trust your instincts, trust that spidey sense that like, this is just not feeling right. And do your homework before you start to get into things that maybe bring you into places that you wish you had not gotten to.
I really like that. And I think that's true with a lot of aspects of dermatology, and probably medicine overall. With new medicines, new techniques, anything new comes out, there might be a tendency to overutilize.
Conversely, what do you think is the most underrated cosmetic treatment?
Wow, that's probably a tough one. I think there are underrated things that are emerging. So I'm going to backtrack just a bit when I answer. So there was this talk about 10 years ago that men were going to make up half of the people that we treated. That never happened. Is that underrated or is it underutilized? Could men do more? Sure. Same thing now with cellulite. That's a place where I think we have a lot of opportunity. I spent a lot of time trying to look into the causes of cellulite, which I think we're getting much closer to understanding. And I think treatments that we have now are underrated. They actually work. Women are really happy. The results are basically permanent. Mm-hmm. I think we can be better, and I think we could treat more. But I think what we're doing with cellulite is probably underrated in terms of sort of advancing that field. The other thing that's underrated, to completely change gears, is not selling to private equity. That's the thing that's underrated, because you know private equity is really exploding in dermatology, and it probably has a role, and I understand why people do it. But I think it's underrated to reevaluate what you're doing and think about whether or not that's the right thing for you and where you think we as a specialty should be and where you as an individual should be.
Absolutely. I think that's really important.
Thanks so much, Dr. Kaminer. Really happy to have you and hope to catch some more of your sessions.
All right. Thanks so much. I really appreciate having me here.
Thank you.
Dr. Kaminer was just about to go until Michelle ambushed him with a question about cosmetic fellowships.
Well, so we've had for about 25 years, we've trained 75 fellows, about 75 fellows over 25 years. We have two fellowship spots. We have one that's a Mohs College approved fellowship spot with my colleague, Dr. Rohr, who runs it. It's one of the world's great Mohs surgeons. And then we have a cosmetic fellowship that we used to do independently, but now it's approved by the American Society for Derm Surgery. It's an ASDS fellowship. There's a bunch of them around the country. So we typically have one spot. Sometimes we have two. This year we have one. And so we train two people a year. One's the Mohs fellow, one's the cosmetic and laser fellow. And they do everything. They sort of get broad exposure. We have a lot of people who come through an interview for the fellowship. So when they interview, they come through and they see the practice. So we get to spend a lot of time with medical students, a little as they think about it, but certainly with derm residents.
Mm-hmm. That's wonderful. You have such a broad base of knowledge and your facilities have such opportunities for training. I think it's got to be a fantastic place to learn.
Yeah, the fellows get a ton. I mean, it's funny because they come and they spend a year with us. And in the beginning, they come in like all excited with all of the training they've had. But a lot of programs, as you know, don't have a ton of cosmetic training. So they come in having learned things online. And then the first thing we say to them is, you need to forget everything you were taught. like literally forget about everything. As we build back up, some of the things that you were taught, you may decide, oh, that was right. Because there's a lot of stuff out there that isn't necessarily the optimal information. Mm-hmm. And so by the end of the year, these guys are rock stars. They can do everything. They know all about everything to do. Importantly, they know how to evaluate things that haven't come out yet. They have a good foundation for, you know, having that BS meter to make sure that they know what's true and what's not. So it's a great way to spend a year if you're looking to fine tune your skills and sort of create a springboard for a successful career down the road.
Well, you're a phenomenal teacher. Even in just a few sessions today, I feel like I already have a better understanding of a lot of our treatments and techniques. And so I think your fellows are very lucky people.
Thank you. That's so nice of you to say. I appreciate that.
Our next guest is one of my personal dermatology heroes, Dr. Larry Eichenfield. Dr. Eichenfield, really appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with us today.
My pleasure to do this.
Do you want to start just by introducing yourself?
Sure. I'm Dr. Larry Eichenfield. I'm a professor of dermatology and pediatrics at the University of California, San Diego, and Rady Children's Hospital, where I also run the pediatric dermatology group.
You also have a great textbook on neonatal dermatology. We, of course, just call it Eichenfield. I refer to that one a lot.
It's proud of that, you know, but there's always new stuff happening in the field as well.
Yeah, that's a great reason to attend conferences like this one. But speaking of new stuff, we've been asking a lot of our guests to tell us things that they have seen that have changed in the field of dermatology since they finished their own residency training.
Well, there's so much that has changed. But I'd probably start with, there are a few drugs themselves that have morphed the field. And then related to those drugs is new information about the disease states. So, hemangiomas, we have a different understanding of, but, you know, propranolol's changed management of hemangiomas and sort of changed our knowledge of them. It's fueled the need to get patients in earlier because we can turn off the process. Isotretinoin, you know, we've had that for acne. We have lots of other stuff for acne, but it's nice to have that backstop where, you know, most patients can be, you know, essentially the process turned off. Certainly atopic dermatitis, an area of great interest to me in my career, you know, the introduction of biologic agents and to a degree the oral JAKs behind that are new medicines that aren't these sort of, unlike our prior medicines, they're not broadly immunosuppressive, right? The biologic therapies or tweak the system differently as do even the oral, as our oral JAK inhibitors do. Huge difference in the lives of patients and their families when they need systemic therapy and we move them to that. It's just incredible to see the changes.
Yeah, I find it hard to imagine a world in which I don't have propranolol for hemangiomas or isotretinoin for acne. I can imagine not having biologics for atopic dermatitis because it was like that when I was in residency, but boy, it seems like the Stone Age compared to what we've got going now. And hopefully that's also optimism for the future. Maybe in 10 or 15 years, we'll be talking about the great drugs we have for hidradenitis suppurativa and other diseases that could really use some help too.
Absolutely. Well, we're at the conclusion of an absolutely fantastic day of pediatric sessions. I deeply enjoyed them. I'm not a pediatric dermatologist, but I'm a fan of pediatric dermatology, and we treat a lot of pediatric patients in beautiful sunny Lubbock, Texas, where I practice. The sessions were so well presented. What would you say would be your top 3 points you would pull out for people to kind of take home?
Well, I think that, let's say for common diseases, right, we have this steady stream of new things coming, and then a set of diseases that are going to be, they're going to get the consequences as well. So alopecia areata is just about there, not yet in the pediatrics, but we are in adults. Right? We never had an approved drug. Now there's an approved drug. Vitiligo, we never had an approved drug. We have a new topical. We'll probably have systemics, potentially biologics as well as a JAK ticket inhibitors. So there's tremendous variation in these inflammatory diseases. On the rare disease side, you know, we just have this, you know, total changing understanding of diseases, most of our birthmarks being mosaic birthmarks, and yet many of them with tremendous consequences. Our ability to treat those with genetically targeted therapies, and then probably the worst disease that we treat in pediatric dermatology, epidermolysis bullosa, you know, being very close to getting approved drugs to manage it. It's just, I think, incredibly positive. And I think depending on when you enter dermatology, like you want to go into it, or you're finishing your residency training, you've been at it a while, these different time points, but you know, the field keeps moving on, but in a way that gives us so much more to offer our patients and their families.
This might be related to what you were just saying, but you've had a, forgive me for saying this, long career and a very distinguished one, and you still seem very passionate about what you do. What's the key to maintaining that fire?
Well, you know, it's easy when you go back to the office and you take care of families. And there are times it's like, I'm so busy, I have so many other things, you know, I'm supposed to be doing an article, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, oh my God, I have to, you know, I got hours starting now, gotta head to the office. But when I'm there, I have patients and families, and we're really engaged together to try to bring the best stuff to them. And I'm fortunate that I'm in a situation where I get to like be in a meeting like this where I'm learning as well as helping to bring in people to educate others, and then bring that back to the clinic, I think is really exciting.
Well, I have to say this conference has been absolutely phenomenal, and I've had take home points that I'm going to be a better dermatologist because of in every single session. And that counts double for today because I think that was a masterclass in pediatric dermatology.
This might be a little bit of a tangent, but because you mentioned it, this is something I've been thinking about just recently over the past few weeks. I heard about an article that looked at people and they pinged their cell phones and they said, what are you doing right now? How happy you are? And who are you doing it with? To try to get a handle on what makes people happy. And they also asked them what they were thinking about. And what they found was that if you weren't thinking about what you were doing, you tended to be less happy. So one of the conclusions was that a wandering mind is an unhappy mind, and a human mind is a wandering mind, because almost nobody was actually thinking about what they were doing. But over the past few weeks, I've been thinking that one thing I really like about being a pediatric dermatologist and a dermatologist in general is that when I'm in there with my patients and their families, I'm so hyper-focused on what's going on. So I'm just fully engaged in them and taking care of that problem, and everything else that's going on fades away. And I think that's a real gift in medicine, and in my case, in dermatology.
So maybe there's less tension with attention. You're staying with what you're doing right at that time, rather than thinking of the 20 other things that may be going. Maybe that makes it easier. And certainly from a patient care perspective, I think, you know, we're quite busy in our fields doing our things, but we're trying to bring the best we can to our patients. And so I think that meetings feel that, but also it's just paying attention to each patient and what they're thinking about, what their situation is, trying to make it better. That's part of what keeps us all going.
You've also trained a lot of students and residents and fellows in your time. What advice do you have for residents and people going into dermatology?
I think, I mean, be thrilled that you're in a field that both continues to change as rapidly as it does, but also brings a lot of appreciation from the people you take care of. I mean, there are some fields where it's not as easy. I did pediatrics before, and I remember people would stop you at a cocktail party to talk about their kids. But in dermatology, they like take their clothes off and show you things.
You got to go to the right kind of party.
So I do think that it's not that people that dermatology is a field where you can really have you get the positive feedback from your patients, which is a marvelous thing. But I also say probably the biggest takeaway is I tell people I don't know anything. You know, I'm always learning, and that's I love that is keep asking questions, figure out what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, and keep reading and learning, because I think it makes us all better at what we do.
I agree. A learning mind is a happy mind.
Well, thanks a lot for being here. We appreciate it. Our final guest of the episode is the return of Dr. Alok Patel. Dr. Patel, thanks for joining us again.
I want to star in a movie and have it be called The Return of Dr. Alok Patel. And I think that alert on Michelle's computer is going to be like the sound that comes up when the movie trailer comes out.
Oh, actually, that was the pimping bell. We were ringing you a pimping bell salute.
I love it. And I'm honored to be here. Thanks for having me.
And as our listeners might guess from the presence of the pimping bell, we are no longer in Hawaii. But Dr. Patel promised he would come back, and we didn't want to let anybody down. And I would like to hear his perspective on dermatology from his perspective as a pediatric hospitalist.
And I'm glad you framed it that way, because I'm pretty sure your listeners are like, why is a pediatrician on this podcast? And I will tell you off the bat, I have so much respect for the field of dermatology, both as a teenager who had horrific acne and needed to be on Accutane twice. Yeah, I was one of those. But then now as a pediatric hospitalist, I only take care of children who are hospitalized at large academic centers. So my interactions with dermatologists is often for really serious conditions, or when we're like, we have no idea what this is, somebody called dermatology. And I will tell you, if it's related to cutaneous issues, malignancies, but also a lot in the newborn nursery, because as both of you know, as anyone in peds dermatology knows, newborns have all kinds of funky rashes. We don't always know what they are. So I have a lot of respect for the academic derms, the peds derms out there, and like their wealth of knowledge in helping us.
Well, we're happy to help. Though I will admit that going to the NICU still always makes me a little bit nervous. Maybe by the time I'm ready to retire, it'll be old hat for me.
Well, you know, it's interesting. As I was thinking about talking to both of you, I thought about this gem in our newborn nursery, and it is a massive newborn dermatology book. I want to almost call it an atlas, because any pediatrician out there can more or less recognize some of the more benign newborn skin conditions. So things like erythematoxicum and milia and newborn acne. And sometimes it looks wild. So even a seasoned nurse might look at this and be like, this is really crazy. And we'll get fooled every now and then. And I'll look at a rash, and in the back of my mind, my freaked out looking for zebras academician mind, I'm like, wait a minute, is this actually ichthyosis? Is it epidermolysis bullosa? Is it something really crazy and congenital that I don't know what it is? And we often are like looking at this book, and I decide whether or not to call derm. And I'll give you all like one example. And this kid turned out to do just fine. It's no big deal. But I get called. It's 2 a.m. It's the charge nurse in the newborn nursery. And she's like, there's a skin condition I've never seen before. That immediately to me is like, oh, I run over there and these nurses are freaking out. And one of them is like, hey, I was Googling and I think this is staph scalded skin syndrome. And I'm like, in a newborn baby? I was like, this is wild. And I run in there, and it legitimately looked like the back of this newborn baby's skin was sloughing off. It looked like erythroderma. It was bright red. And I also was kind of like, this is crazy. Long story short, we have a conversation with the pediatric dermatologist early in the morning, sending photos. And through a little bit of investigation, we found out it was actually mechanical birth trauma from this kid's skin being rubbed too hard with one of those horrific hospital blankets. So you know what? Sometimes it doesn't turn out to be all bad, and our peds dermatologists help us like sleuth through another solution.
Some institutions like to use Brillo pads instead of normal blankets.
It may as well be that way. We need new blankets.
Yeah, those blankets get pretty crunchy at the hospital after a while.
One thing I'm particularly interested in as an assistant professor here at the University of Utah is training pediatricians. We have a lot of pediatrics residents who come through our clinics, and sometimes they hang out with us on the inpatient side. So from your perspective, what should we be doing better, or what do you think the learners would like to know that perhaps we're not properly teaching them?
Oh, I love that. I think one of the most important things off the bat is to know, this is going to sound really broad, but we say sick versus not sick, or normal versus not normal. But what is the instance where you should absolutely call pediatric dermatology? The academic pediatric dermatologist will never get upset if you call them and you don't need to. But it's important for peds residents, for trainees to say, like, hold on, this actually looks concerning to me. Like, what are the signs of Stevens-Johnson syndrome, of DRESS, of serum sickness, of herpes simplex, of herpetic whitlow? Like, what are the signs of it? And more importantly, I think, I should say more importantly, that's pretty important. But another thing that would be really helpful is, what exactly should our trainees convey in a consult call? And that's something that we all can learn. Because every time you call a consult, whether it is cardiology, infectious disease, rheumatology, or dermatology, the consult, there's a specific set of information they want to know. Describe the rash to me. Describe the patient to me. Where is it? What other information could there be to help the dermatologist kind of narrow it down? Because oftentimes, and I hear this in our trainees, I'll hear, we're concerned about a rash. I'll hear a description of it. But the dermatologist on the other end is like, hold on, I need to know a little bit more. Like, tell me about exposures. Tell me about family history. Tell me about anything else. And I think that piece of information coming from you, sir, to your peds trainees could be extremely helpful. And you know what's funny is, when I was a pediatric resident, I was really trying to use your fancy terms like maculopapular 5-centimeter well-demarcated borders. And these peds derms are like, dude, you don't have to do all that. Just like, describe it to me any way you can and send me a photo. But I need to know about the overall patient, because there's a big difference between something that showed up right now versus a patient who may have an underlying issue, and this is turning out to be a cutaneous manifestation of that. So I think those are the two big things, is like, what is a time where you're like, hey, this we need to call immediately, and we need to call in the middle of the night if we have to. And then also, like, what's the most efficient way to talk to a pediatric dermatology consult and give them information they need in that moment?
Well, I think you're right that in the modern age, sending us photographs is a really good idea, especially because we all seem to do a fairly bad job of teaching people how to use our terminology properly.
And I still can't.
Usually we have pediatrics residents rotating in our clinic. Honestly, they don't usually come with us on the inpatient side, but it sounds like they probably should. And of course, the things that get us most concerned are probably the things that have pediatricians most concerned as well. Like, if the patient is sick, otherwise not feeling well, vitals aren't good, then we of course worry that there's something else concerning going on. And then, as long as we mentioned the NICU, I usually don't have to convince pediatricians that we have to be careful about neonatal HSV. So normally anything that has even the possibility of being HSV, patients on acyclovir, they're probably getting a spinal tap, and then we come in and also, you know, swab it and see if we think there's something else on the differential.
For sure.
Good thing
for
acyclovir
sure.
is so safe.
Yeah, I know. It's a good thing that it's so benign. You can throw it out like candy. Can I add one more?
Please.
There are certain, there's also like, there's obviously really more common pediatric derm conditions like atopic dermatitis. I said atopic mm-hmm. dermatitis and
yeah,
eczema.
Sometimes it's atomic.
Sometimes it's atomic.
So bad, it could be atomic. Yeah.
For sure. Erythroderma, like these bright red mm-hmm. eczematous rashes we see. And it's, you know, there are times when it's like your pediatric resident is not necessarily going to treat the eczema without the help of a dermatologist. They're not going to necessarily consult dermatology, but it's important for peds residents to have a baseline understanding of atopic dermatitis. What are the best things that a parent should be doing at home to, you know, take care of their kids? What are those basic things about moisturizing and not using too hot of water and all that stuff we learned? But also the broader conversation that we need to be having in public health about the association of atopic dermatitis with asthma, with hay fever, with food allergies, and what we're collectively doing. I think that, from my perspective, is a much broader conversation that we're going to be having, a multidisciplinary one with dermatology and a lot of other physicians.
Well, really appreciate your perspective, Dr. Patel. Thanks for joining us again. Any place where our listeners can find you? We mentioned earlier that you are kind of a media guy, so where can people learn more about you?
I run around a lot. People can look me up on Twitter or Instagram at Alok Patel, MD, A-L-O-K. You know how to spell Patel because we run healthcare. And MD. I have a website by the same name as well. But I appreciate both of you. And I can tell by after my last rant, you both were like, okay, cool, get off our podcast. I'm just kidding.
No, no, not at all. Actually, it's very helpful information. And knowing how we can help our consultants help us do the best for our patients is a valuable piece of information. So like Luke said, I think asking the question, you know, how sick is this person? Do we think the rash is the big boss? Or do we think that this is just one of the minions of the big boss and it's something else? But I think your perspective was very valuable and we're grateful to have you on.
Well, that will do it for episode 100. Thanks, listeners, for hanging out with us. And of course, a big, gigantic thank you to all of our guests who allowed us to ambush them and sit down with them in front of some microphones this week. Also, thanks to all of the members of Team Dermosphere. We have a crack team of highly motivated and exceptional medical students who help us out with the podcast. They include Morgan Dykeman, Guy Kusecki, Eleonora Marcacci, Michael Birdsall, Aparna Nayak, Neha Deo, Haley Walsh, and Angie Huang. Thanks so much for everything you guys do. Among other things, some things you guys do is maintain our social media accounts. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Michelle in particular has making a push over the past couple days to really put out a bunch of stuff on Twitter and revitalize that. It's been exciting to be able to do some of the stuff, that stuff here at the meeting. You can also find us on our website, dermosphere.podcast.com, which also has links to all of the original articles. And I hope you guys enjoyed us doing something a little bit different this time and taking advantage of the fact that we're here with a bunch of expert dermatologists across all fields of dermatology. If you would like to hear more of us, you can also find us on our other podcast, which is called Skincast. It's been on hiatus in terms of new episodes for a while, but there's a lot of great content still in there. It's really aimed at the general audience, so you might suggest to your patients that you check them out. Listeners, especially if you've been with us from around the beginning, we really appreciate you hanging out with us for 100 episodes of this podcast. It's been a great time, and we will see you next time for episode 101.